Comincerei subito per lasciare un po' di tempo dopo to leave a bit time for question and something like this. So here, Siegfried Zielinski.
Thank you. Thank you, mille grazie. We can also, because we are not so many people, we can also ask questions in between. I'm happy to respond immediately if you want to raise your hand or just start to speak. So we can perhaps make a little dialogue. I'm very grateful to be here. Not only at the festival, but also in Torino. It's my first time in Torino. I've been at so many places, but never in Torino before. So I'm very happy to be here, and I'm very impressed about your work. I know how difficult it is at the moment to do these kind of festivals, these kind of events, these kind of things which are not completely effective in the sense of politicians and of those who have the money, but I have a great respect for that, and I'm happy to support it a little bit. I'm also very happy and proud to be some kind of a to do some kind of preliminary remarks to Bruce Sterling, who is one of my great heroes in paleontology. Come on, don't shake your head. I mean that serious. Your work was very influential for me. Also, on the first glance, it might not look like it, because at least professionally, I don't have anything to do with science fiction. But I'm not sure about that. This is another story. Perhaps we can discuss it afterwards, because my approach to history, to archaeology, perhaps is all about the future. But we can discuss that later, a future which did not take place, but which might have been possible. And this is what I'm interested in. I'm much more interested in possibilities than in reality. And I start with a very strange and very dangerous symbol and sign. During the so-called technological age, guided by a lot of philosophers of the post-histoire, we are used to conceptualize our thinking and our work horizontally on plateaus. Everybody knows about which kind of literature I'm talking. I'm trying to counterpart this kind of quite dangerous stance on the plateau with a vertical movement. The vertical movement, which is for me the movement into the deep layers of what has been, the deep layers of the past, as a tool, as a prosthesis, not to slip on the plateau. My work as a researcher and as a professor and as somebody who organizes academies and things like that, and festivals also, is to create an interplay between these two possibilities. We have to learn to come down from the cross, to descend in a elegant way, which is the most important thing and the greatest challenge for somebody who is trained through Christian Jewish religiosity like me as an exile Polish. The dialectics between the vertical and the horizontal regarding the subject of your festival I'm not interested in the failure in something as something autonomous. I'm interested in the interrelation between the failure, the mistake, the error, this whole phylum. I just learned the word glitch as a terminus technicus for this kind of, and an aesthetical gesture for this kind of phylum. This phylum on one hand, and on the other hand, the established, the truth, the correctness is the tension which builds the theme. It's always defined by those who own the truth, that means who have the power, what is a failure. And what is wrong is defined by those who have occupied what is right. And I'm interested in the dialectics of the two. I give you a very, very perhaps impolite and political incorrect example regarding Italy. Please, please, please excuse me. I have to apologize right from the beginning. But I made some seminars with my students in the last years on the media of the mafia, and we also made a wonderful workshop 2 years ago in Napoli, in the Biblioteca Nazionale, and we deal a lot with the communication systems of the mafia. But I don't want to talk about that today. I want to talk about a meta level about this strange phenomenon, which of course for you, but also for Germany, becomes more and more serious. The Camorra was invented, you can relax as Italians, by the Spanish acquisition. I'm absolutely sure about that. There is no really serious historical work done about that. But I'm sure that it's invented by the Spanish Inquisition in the 15th, 16th century, during the reign of the two Sicilies in southern Italy. And the Camorra originally had the function of a control organ and a spy organ. These were criminals who were spying out those who were not thinking Catholic in the way the Vatican wanted it, and the Inquisition in Spain wanted it especially. They have worn a special jacket so everybody could recognize them, and the jacket had the name which later led to Camorra. But what I want to say at the beginning is just simply as an example, what has been at the beginning an organ of control developed as a mistake, as an error, and is now as an error integrated into the system and helps the machine running. This is a very interesting dialectics, and I think more or less talking about these kind of dialectics, of course, with completely different material. A very brief insight, if you allow, into my own little biography or intellectual socialization. We are becoming, which is strange and somehow I fear it, we're becoming history, so it's not so easy to go back to the points where we started to move into different directions. But for my own work, it was extremely important to choose a very specific institute in Berlin to study. And can I please have the other projection? I think our technician is sleeping already. He's hidden. Can I have the... I will switch between this old machine. I like that very much, but they are dying out, and so I have to prepare more and more with computers. Even in Bogota recently, I didn't have an overhead projector anymore. In China, they don't even know what that is because they jumped over this kind of technological period. I worked with an electronic camera and the transparency is screened on 27 square meters or something like that. That was very funny. So we turned that off. I was studying in an institute which was called Istituto per la Lingua nel Tempo di Tecnologia. My Italian is very bad. Language in a Technological Age. In an abbreviation, it was called either Spitz or Spritz. You know what that is? And we had the same kind of connotation when we used this abbreviation. It was something very, very hype at that time. It was founded in 1961. I came, of course, a little bit later because I'm not that old to study there, end of the 60s. And it was a great opportunity for us to explore philosophy, poetry, in the context of 22 faculties of engineering, of mathematics, of technology, of natural sciences, because it was a technical university. An experimental laboratory within a huge ocean of technology and scientific thinking. The magazine which was published by this institute, here is the first issue, 1961, had themes automatic translation, the counterplay of image and language, the language of radio play. We are in 1961. Which had been extremely interesting for us. It also has the vibration of cybernetics. I come back to that a little bit later. Automatic translation was a big, big issue in cybernetics. and there was a serious political background for this kind of institute and this experimental artwork. 1961, as you all know, was the year where the wall was built in Berlin. In the introduction to this first issue of Spitz or Spritz, the professor and poet Walter Höllerer said, I don't quote him, I just tell you the core of his text. We had been confronted with a language of propaganda of fascism. Now we are confronted with a language of propaganda of the Cold War again. Language has decreased down to something very, very strange, which is extremely opposite to poetry. Let's give the machines a chance to do it better. Let's try if they can do it better. There was this utopian thinking and feeling that the machines might be able to do much, much better than the human beings. I will, if I forget it, I say it now, my short speech will correspond with this thesis, but at the same time will turn it around, vice versa. My thesis is that men are the better machines, but this is something which we should perhaps discuss at the end. This was one of the backgrounds of our work at that time. The other one, Max Spencer and the school in Stuttgart. Max Spencer, philosopher of technology and a natural scientist. He wrote wonderful texts already in the 1930s on technical existence, for example. He wrote his dissertation on quantum physics and its relation to philosophy. And he published in 1960 a book which was called Programming of Beauty. That was, of course, a shock for all the poets and all the artists. Programming of beauty. Beauty is something you can program. Amazing. Precise pleasures. Pleasures can be precise. Absolutely mad, crazy, this man. The preciseness of enjoyment or something like that.
Of course, Max Benzer knew that the programmable part of beauty is not the whole beauty. Of course he knew that he only shifts through parts of this very much inaccessible realm, those parts who are organized, but he insisted that these organized parts of beauty are existing and you can program them, you can formalize them, you can put them into formulas, and then you can start to play, to work. Also, Max Benzer's work had a strong utopian implication, and so had, of course, you know all about him, Bertolt Brecht, who came from a completely different angle of working and of thinking and of arts. As many of you know, he wrote in 1929 a so-called radio theory, a theory of telecommunications, which is not a theory, it's more a heuristics or something like that. And in the center of this heuristic explication was a radio play, which was called The Flight Over the Ocean, The Ocean Flight, The Flight of the Lindberghs. Brecht tried always to make it more and more anonymous. It started with The Flight of the Lindberghs, and then it was, first it was Charles Lindbergh, then the Lindberghs, then it was The Flight Over the Ocean. I just play you a few seconds of a jewel which you might have never heard before. It's the shellac recording of the 1929 original performance of that piece by Scherchen, directed by Scherchen. I play you this part where the apparatus sings. The apparatus is the choir of the whole piece, the interactive part, so to speak, in Brecht's sense. We need loud sound, please, so because it's an old recording. Here is the apparatus. We are waiting for you in Europe. We are completely identifying with the machine. We are the apparatus. It was the choir, the audience who was singing this part. We are the apparatus. We are identical with the machine. The complete identification, again, as a utopian idea to create something different than the society which was established. This is one of the first work I did in this field in 1972. I think it's nearly 40 years ago. It was a project that was called For Mass Media, that are media of the masses. My explication of a materialistic media theory, and with the help of an artist, we created this, of course, borrowed from the May in Paris, from the May 68 in Paris, this very, very primitive erected male fist, which showed this is what we want, a materialist media theory, a science of media, and it was connected with a communist who was a very good theoretician, Holzer. We wanted him to have the chair for media theory, of course. And more relaxed, I went into writing the history of the videotape recorder in the 80s, in the early 80s, at a time when most of the professors even didn't know what a video recorder was. They couldn't spell the word. They thought it's something you can wear or something like that, but it, of course you can wear it also. I'm very proud in 2010, just a few weeks ago, the book which I published 1985 in German was republished with the absolute same text from 1985, that's 25 years ago, the absolute same text in a new edition, and I'm of course very happy about it. At this time, as you can see, the mobile versions of video, the wearable versions of video, was already the Sony Portopack, a great issue. Video Guerrilla was a great issue. We know, and I don't want to go today into that, to play with the error, the mistake, the interruption, the void in the signals and so on, was a very important part for that early machines, especially these two half-inch tapes, open reel tapes, of course, were very, very. They always produced errors, but we tried to make them productive and tried to make the best out of it. Another 10 years later, short 10 years later, I was director of this academy in Cologne. Yesterday, we saw already this image by Stanley Stahl and Kirk Wulfert. I digged it out for two reasons. First, to make a small correction, if I may. This was my first diploma in Cologne, this cyber SM piece. I had to stand in this suit to test it, to test the electrical sensors and so on. The more important person was Kirk Wulfert, not Stanley Stahl. Kirk Wulfert was the programmer. He did the whole programming work, and Stanley Stahl tends to forget that. He was the spectacular guy from Norwegian, from Oslo, who ate raw meat and bloody fish and so on. And of course, he was the sensual, sensational part of the project. But Kirk Wulfert was the one who programmed the whole piece. I also have a documentation in my computer, but that's all now boring stuff. It's history already. I mean, it's nearly 20 years ago. The other reason why I show it is because this piece, of course, was full of errors. The basic was the mistake the two artists took right from the beginning while they were designing this piece. They started at this point that erotics is something you can organize via ISDN. This is a big mistake, of course, because the world of the ISDN and the telephone connections we needed at that time to play the piece between Paris and Cologne and so on, this whole realm is the realm of rationality. Every second you have to do a rational decision. And on the other hand, you should feel the sensation of erotics. Impossible. It's a paradox. But of course, as a discussion tool, this was a great project. I enjoyed it a lot, and we had a lot of wonderful performance. Another 10 years later, this image was some kind of helping me to work in different kinds of directions. The mobile as a gravestone, which was of course thought here by the one who had the gravestone built as a communication tool with God. But of course, for me, it was the memorial for the mobile and not for the person who was buried here. For me, latest at the beginning of the new millennium, I started to think about a time, a period, which I simply and operational called art after the media, art after the strategical option of the media. This could be perhaps a nice subject for festival next year or the other year or in a few years. We must not name it like that, but the ideas behind it is what counts. The I'm absolutely convinced, and I would be very happy to discuss that with you, that the strategical option of the media is over. It's not attractive anymore. It's not the center of any attraction of artists and of intellectuals and so on. If you go through all the advanced so-called philosophical writings at the moment, you have media implicit theories and theoreticians, Giorgio Agamben, Jacques Rancière, and all the others, not explicit, referring to the media as a concept. The media as a concept has become a power concept. It has arrived in the center of society. And what we have to do now is not something which might be without media. This is impossible. But to integrate what we like and what we are passionate for, the relation of science, technology, and arts, into a praxis where the media is no longer a strategic concept. I hope that at the end of my talk it becomes a little bit clearer what I mean about that. I traveled a lot through southern Italy for the last 10 or 15 years, and I'm very fascinated. I have a huge collection already of this, I call it the electrification offensive in South America. The churches in Sicily, Calabria, and so on mainly are electrified. This has, of course, a reason which is very obvious and superficial. Most of the non-electrical mechanical objects, the artifacts, are quite valuable, and most of them are stolen. So this is, and the electrical ones aren't very cheap. But this is just a side aspect. For me, much more important is that these kind of little machines stand for a change of attitude in the relation between man and machine. During the 1950s, 1960s especially, 1970s, we started to trust into machines. We started to believe the machines, for example, that they can do better than we. They are faster, they are more effective in special realms and so on. These machines are believing machines of a special kind. They believe in us. The reason is very simple. I take the example of this offerta. Everybody knows that, these offerta machines. Usually you put a candle into the church and then your soul is present in the house of God. These machines work electrically. There's a press button and an electric light. The interesting thing about it is that usually the light lights also without you throwing money into it. That means the machine believes that you threw the money into it. The machine is more trustable than we are. Or the other way around. The most beautiful one is in Napoli. No, the human Napoli 2005. That's my favorite one. One of the first I recorded with monochrome. And I hope I can make a nice project out of that. Believing machines, the machines which believe in us, they can have mistakes, no problem. We can compensate them very easily, and sometimes it's even our advantage to be confronted with their mistakes. There are other machinery which do not need the fetishization of mistakes and errors. These are these kind of machines. This is a ring of a particle accelerator, the test version of Max Planck Institute from 2009. It looks like a video art or media art installation, but it's a very serious engine, system of machines, these test drive machines don't need the error. If an error comes up, it can be very, very dangerous for human beings. We produced the big machinery around us as paradise machines, as machines of paradise, of heaven, to compensate the lacks of our human existence, the limited human existence. But they turned out to be hell machines in many, many places, in many, many cases. Big aeroplanes, the question of scale, much too big, much too big, much too fast, and the accidents which are connected with that. This realm of machinery does not need at all the fetishization of mistake. And it does not need the implication that we are discussing in the context of arts, that glitch is something beautiful. A glitch inside of that can cause serious, very serious trouble for generations of people, as we know from the new attacks in the system of some atom computer arrangements in the Iran just recently. You have read about it. These are the dangers of the future, and we have no reason at all in this context to glorify the mistake. It's a dangerous thing because the avant-garde, this is at least my thesis, grew up with the thesis of, with the attitude of glorifying the mistake. But this was a different situation in the 1910s and in the 1920s when the Russians were attacking the establishment, when Elisitsky was beating the Mensheviki with the Bolsheviki, the white homogeneous circle with a red triangle. This was a different political situation to now. The establishment was strong, it was extremely lazy, it was fat, and it was absolutely consequent to take strategies and tactics of destruction, temporarily destruction at least, to create something different, like Man Ray did when he ruined the film stripes, cut it and other people, and made something completely different out of the projection. The fear of technology, the fear of that the great system can have errors, failures, was very, very constitutive for what we call cybernetics. Cybernetics was extremely successful in building up the anti-entropy system, but not technologically, but psychologically, politically, and sociologically. What you see here in the background is a new work by Istanbul artist Ali Kazma. I like his work very much. It's called Obstructions. It's meanwhile 28 or 29 large pieces where he documents very simple the functioning of human beings within a big machinery. The idea that man function within these mega machines of production. For example, the production of jeans to make them look dirty from the beautiful start. In Istanbul, there are, in India, there are huge, huge factories for that. Or Alessi production, fine design production, slaughtery, brain surgery. There are many, many subjects he's dealing with, and they have this common vibration of a functioning circle of man-machine relationship. The second avant-garde after the Second World War was already different. I rediscover at the moment, I don't know, Bruce, how familiar you are with his work. Most of the younger artists are not so much. I at the moment rediscover Brian Gissin's work, a great guy who always was somehow in the shadow a little bit of William Burroughs. But he did an enormous amount of interesting work. He died in 1984, I think, quite unknown. He is a great hero of many rock musicians, like Genesis B. Orridge, like David Bowie, like others, Lou Reed, experimental rock musicians, who, for the reason you will see in 1 second, together with Burroughs, but I think that Gissin was the driving motor behind it, they worked a lot, this is very well known, with the concept of cut-ups, of destroying pieces of poetry, for example, or imagery, and then rebuild it again through the act of deconstruction in a material sense. This is one example from The Third Mind from 1965. But I especially discovered his early permutative poetry. This is a poem, permutative poetry from 1961 called Junk is No Good Baby. And the poem is just permutative, going through the possible combinations of the five words, which has already quite a rich variation. And to give you an idea of what I will present later when I go a bit deeper into history, I play you a little piece which hopefully you don't know, or most of you don't know yet. It's called The Pistol Poem, constructed by Brian Gissin and William Burroughs in 1962 in Morocco. This was the place where they liked to live. They didn't like Europe, they didn't like the States, and they had good reasons, legal reasons, to go away from these countries. They lived in Morocco and made a piece for the BBC. And the piece, for me, has a nearly a paradigmatic value, because the basic sound for this piece is pistol, the shots of a pistol. And they make an ecstatic rhyme out of this destruction, the sound of destruction, the pure sound of destruction. They perform, or they transform, into something melodic, into something rhythmic. We need quite a lot of sound, because this is a very, very bad recording. I just play you a little bit of that piece, 1962. Permutation as an alternative to destruction,
or here the combination of permutation and destruction. In 1961, a few months before this poem was constructed, Nanni Balestrini went into a bank in near Milano together with Umberto Eco, who was very young at that time, together with a technician of IBM, and they sat down in this huge IBM 7070, I think it was the 7070 machine, which was a complete room and which was serving the bank to make their complex mathematics and informatics faster. And they sat down and generated this poem. Mark I, which was, of course, a very special name because Mark I was the name of the sequence-controlled calculator from the 40s in the United States, which was after the set 3 from Zuse, the second Turing machine in the history of the computer. Nanni Balestrini called this permutative poem Tape Mark I. It was a permutation of texts. I also brought you the translation into English. We translated at the moment. I'm very close with Nanni Balestrini to do this work at the moment. He's much more than 17 now, so we have to do this work now. This is the kind of archaeology we have to do, the practical archaeology we have now to do now. These people are dying. And very, very valuable parts of our own history are dying. We discussed that already in the exhibition upstairs. I'm coming just from a seminar at the ZKM about archives. The problem is the storage capacity is growing immensely. It's growing immensely. We can, on a few square meters, we can store many gigabytes of material. But it only lasts for 5 years or for 10 years. The duration of time is getting shorter and shorter of archival time, and the capacity of what can be archived gets larger and larger. This is a paradox we are not dealing yet with, and at least to work with the scripts, what is scripted, and to learn about the scripts is the smallest thing we can do. A little bit later, the Italian colleagues will know about that. Balestrini wrote Tristano, his interpretation of the Tristano myth in 1964, which was a permutative text, consisted out of 300 small chapters. 200 chapters were permutable. He changed them completely in combinations. 100 he kept as a continuity, so that the story somehow, the core of the story, stood solid. His revolutionary idea was in 1961 that everybody should have his or her own novel, because every book which should have been printed was a unique version, or at least nearly a unique version, because there were, I think, a few billion possibilities of permutation, with 200 chapters organized in a random form of combination. 1964. This year, in 2010, a German publisher, Suhrkamp, very powerful, realized this dream by Nanni Balestrini. And they printed 2,000 copies, where every copy is not a copy, but a unikat, because it contains a unique text. Nearly 50 years later, after this utopian idea, Nanni Balestrini was a leftist, a Marxist. He was sharing this kind of utopian ideas I mentioned at the beginning. He wanted everybody to have his or her own novel, and not just a thing which is produced in masses on a fleeceband, you know, on this accelerator thing.
Of course, many people don't know about him because he made big political mistakes. He was a close friend of Negri and some of the others, whom you know very well. And he was accused of being part of the complot against Aldo Moro. And he took his skis and went over the Alps to Paris, where he still lives, commutes between Paris and Rome. and he was staying pretty unknown until the last years. Umberto Eco has digged him out again, because Umberto Eco, I think, has to be very grateful for him. This idea of permutative texts are very basic for his bestseller novels. I'm very convinced about that, but this is another story, another issue. Balestrini, the utopian idea, and poetry and the precision of pleasures. Just a quick excursion into what was mentioned already, my current work, the variantology research. I only try to do it in a few minutes because I can see that time is starting to run out. The mention of variantology or variantologia for me is some kind of an operation to deal with the complex issues of the past and connect them to, as I said at the beginning, a possible future. I do not look at the past with the interest to find out what but with the intention to find out what might have been instead, also in alternative of, and so on. The single investigations, the tactics which form the imaginary sum of variantologica, I call genealogies, which is not a neologism or an invention by myself that comes from Foucault and Nietzsche, but I don't want to do a theory seminar today. This is another seminar. The most important point is in the concept of Nietzsche, very, very closely connected with your subject. Can I have the other screen again? With the subject of error and mistake, Nietzsche and following him very closely, Foucault, were dedicating the concept of genealogy, or were combining it very strongly. Can I have that?
Okay.
With the concept of error and mistakes, they are not believing in the idea of they are not believing in the idea of a linear history. Genealogy does not go back into the past to erect a large continuity beyond the diversion of forgetting. To follow the complex string of derivation means much more to grasp what has happened in derivation. Incidents, breaks, errors, false builds, which generated what exists and has value for us. To work with such a concept means, and again we are in the realm of the dialectics of truth and false, it means to have to give up very, very basic concepts in historical thinking. This is a model which was illustrating Hegel's philosophy of the history of the world. You see on the right China, India in the middle, Persia, and then the European part, Roman world, and at the end, the highest form of complexity in the true sense of layers, complexity, the so-called Germanic world, the highest form of culture, the highest form of freedom, and so on and so on. Hegel was very, very conservative in this series of lectures. And what is very interesting, Mohammedism, the Arabic Islamic culture, is getting into this system like an interface, like an irritating interface. It accompanies the Oriental development and the Greek and Roman development for a while, and then it goes off somewhere completely different, gets out of history, out of history, not important for history anymore. A very, very Eurocentristic model of history, influential for historians all over Europe and all the United States of America in a very, very strong way. I don't have the time to go deeper into it, but these are the constructions we have to give up. Alternatively, and this gives you a hint why I doubt more and more that we are living in a situation which is most advanced in history, that we are the avant-garde. Alternatively, look at the system of knowledge and the distribution of knowledge which Al-Farabi, an Muslim philosopher from the 9th century, early 10th century, did. A very dynamic distribution of knowledge within Europe and the Arabic countries and the Asian countries, and with strong links to other continents already. And this is where I'm diving through at the moment a lot. At first, we made a strong movement to China, to East Asia, where the sun goes up, where the sun starts. We discussed with a gang of very interesting acoustic people, engineers, historians of physics from the Academy of Beijing and from other places, their own deep time story. The Chinese people immediately understood this term, tempo profundo, because they have a strong deep time culture. And they are very proud of it, of course. And they understood that immediately. When I try to explain to Dai Nian Tzu, he is one of the brightest Chinese wise men in natural sciences, Einstein Award winner, and so on and so on. When I try to explain to him what I mean when I talk about variantology and art before the media, he said, okay, he interrupted me after 1.5 sentences and said, okay, you're talking about art before the media. I said, okay, it's not completely correct, but we can put it like that. This is a strange setup full of errors. When I showed that the first time to a gang of Czech lists, specialists for the chess game, in Prague, some 2 years ago in conference. They were historians of chess, of the chess game, and I did that piece, and they were tearing me apart because they said this has nothing to do with chess. It's a failure from their point of view because the board, which you can see here, has not the exact construction like a contemporary chess board. It has more fields than a contemporary chess board. But this is a chess board, and it is a chess automaton, to make the whole story very short. It comes from the 2nd century before Christ. The board is made of lodestone, and the figures are constructed from iron and the blood of cocks. So you have the symbiosis, unfortunately, Stellak is still sleeping or not there, the symbiosis of flesh, blood and metal in a very early stage of constructing automatons already. A combination of shredded iron and blood of the cock gives you a highly magnetic material. And this magnetic material, of course, reacts in repulsion and attraction in relation to the board, which was made of lodestone. So you had a chaotic situation of this automaton. The figures were fighting with each other, so to speak, and the game was called the chess. Fighting chess figures automatically played. Do I have a few more minutes or is it over? Yeah. You must give me the sign. Just this little tool from the Chinese world. A quick excursion into the Arabic Islamic world. I'm sorry, I'm so deep into it at the moment, you hardly can get me out, and I can talk easily for days about that, but I will try to do it in 5 minutes. one of the most fascinating gangs of people from the Arabic Islamic context comes from Baghdad, from the House of Wisdom in the 9th century. It was a gang of three brothers called the Banu Musa. I'd heard of them. Sometimes they appear in histories of machines. The Banu Musa was a small cooperative, we would call it nowadays. They were qualified in different fields of sciences and philosophy and aesthetics, music. And they put their forces together, their energies together, their qualifications, and constructed an enormous amount of works. They did a lot of translations too, but this is not so important. One of the hard cores of their machinery, of their collection, so to speak, is a musical machine, an automaton, which plays permanently how to generate permanent energy in form of air pressure with the help of hydraulics. This is what the manual on the right hand show you, and how it was constructed by hydraulical means. This is a sketch I took from a very interesting book from 1931 and adapted it, which explains the machinery very roughly. On the left hand you have the energy supplier, endless, interruptless energy in form of pneumatics. On the right hand you have the mechanical part, the cylinder with pins, the rotating cylinder, which is connected to, in this case, an organ pipe, but it could be any instrument. This is very interesting. Banu Musa, when they describe this instrument, this is a universal machine. They use this term, a universal machine. You should be able to play every instrument in the world with it. It's just a question of the endless supply of energy and the mechanical part and this heart, which is in the center of this drawing. This is the programmable part, so to speak, the cam cylinder and the pins, which are located at different positions and which the program for the machine. Depends on the order of the pins, which kind of music you can play, which kind of rhythms, which kind of tones you can play. We know that also a lot of little elements had been wrong in the device by the Banu Musa. The imagination of this universal music machine was extremely strong. We are in the 9th century. And even hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, also there were slight errors, technical mistakes into it. It's the master model, without the later people knowing about Banu Musa, for many, many machinery afterwards. This is a programmable cam cylinder for a system of belts in Belgium. I just show you a few examples, very familiar to you from the 18th century, an automatic piano, a trumpet, which has already, let's say, the negative side of the cam cylinder drum, the paper with the pinholes in it as the program. And we could end when we would make such a genealogy with a robotic flute player from the Waseda University in Tokyo playing Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of a Bumblebee. I also saw him playing, I heard him playing. Compared with what the Banu Musa had in mind 1200 years ago, it's pretty boring and not very elegant. I always said to the Japanese colleagues, I like his hat. Should I stop? Simon, shall I stop? Okay. The idea of a second excursion, I would go into the realm of perhaps one of the most ingenious engineers of the early 13th century, late 12th century, early 13th century, Al-Jazari. He's a little bit more known, but his manuals, his books are not very well known. With the help of Arabic scholars, with the help of some English translations, we try to reconstruct this wonderful world of machinery. For example, the horologium, which was developed already in the 9th century as a musical automaton in high precision, telling you what time of the day and what time of the night it is, a musical audiovisual automaton. A colleague from the University of Aachen reconstructed the whole thing in a simulation for us, and it proved, by the way, and this is extremely important about what we have discussed before, it proved that the manual which Al-Jazari has written is absolute perfect, no errors, no mistakes. You can build the machine after this manual from 1206, and this is how it looks like, the manual. It also gives you a completely different idea how the Arabic Islamic culture treated figurative painting, figurative drawings, the relation between image and text, which is now such a hype theme in hypertext formations in the internet and so on, is here already in a very, very rich way. There, intersections of text and images in the most beautiful way. I can only make you hot to read perhaps our newest books, which is exactly on this Arabic Islamic technology, Variantology 4, where we also discussed and analyzed these kind of drinking machines, which were constructed for parties, for orgies, to make the participants of parties drunk as fast as possible. So there are so many layers and stories of Arabic Islamic culture in such a silly way. It's discussed at the moment. We don't say anything to this actual discussion. We don't even name it. But through the way we are presenting this, hopefully it becomes clear the mistake we make when we regard the Arabic Islamic culture as some kind of a primitive culture or even a pre-human culture, which some politicians are doing at the moment. Answering machine, this is the last thing I'm showing. We heard it yesterday from Stellag. This is an answering paper machine from the 9th century, the Sa'iraya, which is an astrological device. One of our great collaborators, David Link, who is specialized in the history of algorithms, of algorithmic devices, and the archaeology of algorithmic devices, managed to find out the code for this astrological device. It's an answering machine. You can ask this paper machine simple questions about the world, about your existence, like yesterday, we practiced it here. Where are you? Are you beauty? And what is your identity? And whatever. And this machine answers you in a very simple way. Of course, you have to write the answer down, and you have to know the algorithm, how it works. And there we are, looking at this beautiful answer from Birma. Looking at this beautiful clip from Edison from 1889, at the end, who makes you think where breakdance and hip-hop comes from Detroit or from somewhere else. Perhaps another example for the idea that you can find again and again in the past constellations which are in a specific sense much further than we are nowadays, and which are questioning our notion of progress. What I'm doing, I only had the chance to give you a small insight, is permanently to plea for the culture for experiment, which includes, of course, we heard that yesterday from our colleague from Ljubljana, which includes, of course, the possibility of failure. To fail in dignity is a precondition for experimenting. To fail in dignity, not to fail at all, but to fail in dignity, that's something different. And failing in dignity means we should not give our energy for what I call the test department, the future of society as a test department,
There was a great rock band some 20 years, 25 years ago called the Test Department. They were feeling that already. Society as a test department. Test is something completely different. And for tests, we will always get a lot of money. A hell lot of money. This is exactly the example you were talking about yesterday. If you don't mention the artist and so on and so on, and you organize the application as a test, you get money, whatever you like, roboting, whatever it is. But experiment, including the chance of failing or failure in dignity, is something completely different. The culture of experiment as a possibility of what has been the past and what might be the future. This is what I was wanted to talk about. I hope it came a little bit over to you. Sorry for being too long. Thank you for your attention.
Grazie, professor Zielinski.